Studies at Marine Corps University presents The Turkish Model, Turkey's Role in the Arab Spring, presented by Dr. Soner Çigapte, Washington Institute for Near East Policy. This is the fourth lecture in a series being hosted by MES at MCU entitled Orienting Our Sights on the Future, the Opportunities and Challenges of the Arab Revolts. Soner Çigapte is a senior fellow and director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations, Turkish domestic politics, and Turkish nationalism, published in numerous scholarly journals and major international print media. He also is a regular columnist at Hürriyet Daily News, Turkey's oldest and most influential English-language newspaper. A historian by training, Dr. Çigapte wrote his doctoral dissertation at Yale University on Turkish nationalism. Dr. Çigapte has taught courses at Yale, Princeton University, Georgetown University, and Smith College on the Middle East, Mediterranean, and Eastern Europe. His spring 2003 course on modern Turkish history was the first offered by Yale in three decades. From 2006 to 2007, he was Ertegun Professor at Princeton University's Department of Near Eastern Studies. Dr. Çigapte is the recipient of numerous honors, grants, and chairs. He also served as chair of the Turkey Advanced Area Studies Program at the State Department's Foreign Service Institute. This lecture took place Thursday, 12 January 2012, at the Gray Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Sir, thank you for coming, everyone here, and Rowdy, good to have you. Thank you very much for coming from Charlottesville, always. We are now on the fourth lecture on the series on the Arab Spring, and some of you may ask, the last time you checked, Turkey was not a member of the Arab country, and that is correct. This actually is, as I said last week, I think, the Turkish inclusion of Turkey as part of the Arab Spring came from requests that we received, actually, more than one. And I think it was a very good request. It's not that something is going on in Turkey, you know, upheaval or what we're seeing in countries such as Egypt or Tunisia or Libya or any of those, but it is the, I would even say this, pivotal role that Turkey has played in this, perhaps a role that no other country in anywhere has played. You know, the fact that the Turkish president was the only head of state that actually traveled to Egypt, to Libya, to Tunisia, I believe also, and it wasn't Iranian, everybody thought this brings an Iranian style, or Iran, pro-Iran governments. No, it was Turkey. And you know, in Syria, I think we will hear that Turkey is playing an amazing role. And it's actually good that we have this talk right after Syria. So when I looked around about Turkey and who should be the best person, I think we are very, very lucky and privileged to have somebody at the level of Dr. Soner Çigapte, who I read all he writes. And by the way, I don't know how you do it. You humble me by writing. He writes so often and all good. A lot of people write, but they're not good. He writes.
I drink a lot of coffee.
On a daily basis. And I said, you know what, let me call on him and see if he would accept our invitation. And we're very, very grateful that you have accepted that. Dr. Çigapte is a senior fellow and director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute. We are making sure he's drinking in a mug from the Washington Institute. He feels at home. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations, Turkish domestic politics, and Turkish nationalism, published in numerous scholarly journals and major international print media. He's also a regular columnist for the Hürriyet Daily News. That's in Turkey, the Turkey's oldest and most influential English-language newspaper. He's a historian by training, which also makes it dear to my heart, because I'm a historian by training as well. He wrote his doctoral dissertation at Yale University in 2003 on Turkish nationalism. And he has taught courses at Yale, Princeton, Georgetown University and Smith College on the Middle East, Mediterranean, Eastern Europe. And this spring course in 2003 on Turkish history, modern Turkish history, was the first offered by Yale in 30 years. And he, from 2006 to 2007, he was a professor at the Princeton University Department of Near Eastern Studies. Again, another thing that makes this course because I studied there. He's a recipient of numerous honors, grants, and chairs. And he also serves as the chair of the Turkey Advanced Area Studies Program at the State Department's Foreign Service Institute. Okay? Again, thank you very much for coming, and the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure. I think I'm going to stand up and thank you again for inviting me, Dr. Tarzik. I'm very happy to be here today for this conversation. I want to thank the Marine Corps University as well for having me over here. Obviously, you cannot discuss the Arab Spring without discussing Turkey. Turkey having taken such an active role in the Arab Spring, but also Turkey's experience as a democracy and a Muslim majority country should be providing us with food for thought. Now that the dictatorships are falling in some of the Arab countries, so the question is where they go, Turkey be an example. So I'm here today to have a conversation on those issues, and I agree with that. I mean, that obviously Turkey is not an Arab country, so you cannot imagine how many times I get this question. People always ask me when I tell them Turkish origin. They say, well, do you speak Arabic? I was an exchange student here many years ago. I was born and raised in Istanbul, and I became an American later on, but came here for the first time in exchange when I was 17. I went to Northern California, very nice. I was not on the beach, but I was in the mountains. So I saw real America, which was great. I liked it. And that's what made me fall in love and come back. This was such a great year. I loved it. And I'm a great believer in exchange as a result of that. Anyhow, so that year in high school, and you know how it goes, people were picking on me for being a Turk. And one of the questions I would get is if I spoke Arabic, I would always say, do you speak Latin? You guys did. But if you speak Aramaic and Latin, then I speak Arabic. I am a scholar of Turkey. I study the country. I wrote my dissertation on Turkish nationalism. It's an issue that's quite important. I wrote about Islam's role in defining Turkish identity, another issue that's quite important for today. So what I'd like to do is kind of give you a three-part conversation. If I go too fast, there are any acronyms, names, can't catch, just stop me. I'm more than happy to add on the board for you. I will start with a conversation first on Turkey's new foreign policy as it relates to the Arab Spring and the kind of things they're doing with us and how that impacts Turkey's ties to the United States in a rather positive manner. I will talk about that, which will be quite a change. I came here only last year. I was across the whole Brehman Hall to do a lecture, and I talked about how we had so many problems with the charts on foreign policy issues. From Iran to Syria, and most of these have gone away because the Arab Spring has created a unique set of avenues of cooperation between us and the Turks. So I'll talk about that first. Then I'm going to look at Turkey's own experience as a democracy, what that means for countries experiencing the Arab Spring, whether we can take some lessons from Turkey, and also traps that Turkey shows up that we should avoid, because it goes both ways. There's a lot of talk about the Turkish model lately. Model and it's not. We'll talk about both. And finally, I'm going to end up with a conversation on our ties with Turkey and what the future holds. Those of you following the strategic environment of Turkey and U.S.-Turkish relations, that would be an interesting part for us to finish with, especially in terms of Turkey's ties with Iran, Israel, Syria, Iraq, and our ties with the Turks as we look at the Middle East. So let me first start with how Turkey's foreign policy has changed as a result of the Arab Spring and how that has really been a good thing. I know most of these lectures, you guys probably end up getting a lot of bad news. I'm going to start with the good part of it, because there's a lot of good stuff going on. If you looked at Turkey's foreign policy about a year ago, you could identify so many areas of problems. The Turks seem to be really good friends with Assad, who's not a friend of the United States. They had a deteriorating relationship with Israel. On top of it, they did not seem to be full-heartedly committed to NATO as well as U.S. policy of Iran. They had, for example, voted against U.S.-backed UN-sponsored sanctions at the UN Security Council in June 2010. And they seem to be, you know, kind of supportive of Iran's nuclear policy, where they were saying Iran has the right to pursue nuclear research for peaceful purposes, and that even if they are doing, nuclear research, that's no problem. So a lot of people were looking at this and saying that Turkey's foreign policy, as it was shaped by this new ruling party, Justice and Development Party, which came to power in 2002, also known by its acronym as AKP. A lot of people were saying that this is really not very good because we have seen it's not your mother's Turkey. Turkey of the past would have been categorically with the United States on most foreign policy issues as it was in the Cold War and in the 90s, whereas when the AKP came to power in 2002, that started to change. Part of that was that the AKP is rooted in Turkey's Islamist opposition. It's no more opposition because it's in government now. This has been ruling for the last 10 years. A lot of people are saying it's an ideological foreign policy, which really sees Turkey as a country that should oppose U.S. interests in the region. And that was, to a large extent, a valid argument. You could look at so many foreign policy issues and see the difference between us and the Turks until the Arab Spring started. The Arab Spring, I think, was unexpected for everyone, but also for the Turks, because until the Arab Spring started, the Turks went out and made a point of establishing really good relations with their Muslim neighbors, which the previous governments had ignored, because when Ataturk set up Turkey as a modern republic in the 1920s, one of the ideas he promoted was, he said, Turkey is a European state, we just turn our back on the Ottoman legacy, and we become European, and Turkey there ignored the entire Middle East neighborhood for about almost a century. The AKP reversed this trend when it came to power in 2002, and said, no, we got to go back to the Middle East and take an active foreign policy, and this is what they, when they launched their foreign policy, known as zero problems with neighbors. So Turkey had problems with Iran and Syria and Iraq, and they said, we're going to get away with all these problems, and they tried hard, and it worked. For a number of reasons, once because they reached out, the Iranians and the Syrians were happy to see a NATO ally reach out to them because that brings them legitimacy and cachet in international politics. But there were other reasons that helped improve Turkey's ties with three Middle Eastern neighbors. Four Turkey's Middle Eastern neighbors, you could not get such good neighbors if you tried. They're Iran, Iraq, and Syria. Really tough neighborhood. So Turkey's ties with all these three countries improved in the 1990s, but especially after the AKP came to power after 2002, because this new government reached out in a departure from Turkey's established foreign policy of ignoring these countries and standing with the U.S. or the Middle East. The AKP said that they just did not want to be the West's man in the region. They just wanted to be in their own, kind of an independent streak of foreign policy. But one more issue that really helped improve Turkey's ties with three countries is this group called the PKK. This is on the State Department's list of foreign terrorist organizations. It stands for Kurdistan Workers' Party. It's a party of Turkish Kurds who want independence for Kurds in Turkey, and they use violence and terrorist attacks to this end. They were put on the list of the FTO list of State Department back in 1999, and since then they have been launching, and even before that, attacks into Turkey. The group had bases in all these three countries in the 90s and 80s, and it launched attacks into Turkey from all these three countries. I know there's a lot that we can take from today's conversation, but one thing you could always take as an analytical tool and use it, without doubt, when you look at Turkey's relations with its Middle Eastern neighbors, is the following. The PKK. If a country helps the PKK against Turkey, it becomes enemy number one. And if a country helps Turkey against the PKK, it becomes Turkey's best friend. That's simple. And I think this is a prism through which the Turks have looked at their ties to the Middle East, and still do. The relations with Iran, Iraq, and Syria changed because all these three countries, for different reasons, stopped supporting and harboring the PKK about a decade ago. With Syria, it changed because Turkey actually put pressure on Syria. There was evidence that the Syrians not only harbored the PKK, but also provided it with training camps. This being the region of war of proxies, of course the Syrians would not have the camps inside Syria, but they would have them, anybody wants to guess? Or in Lebanon. which they controlled in the Bekaa Valley, but nevertheless, this, everybody knew that this was a Syrian operation that the PKK had camped in the Bekaa Valley. And Turkey knew this, not only that, but the leader of the PKK, his name is Öcalan, and then Umut, he actually lived in Damascus. So this is Turkey's major terrorist threat. Its leader lives in Damascus. He would grant interviews to BBC byline Damascus, and then the Turks would the next day call the Syrian ambassador and say, what is this? He would say, oh, he would say he doesn't live in Damascus. We have no proof. The Turks would then provide the Syrians with the address where he lived, probably given to them by the Israelis. And then the Syrians would say, well, tomorrow we'll take you to this address where you claim he lives. The next day they would take the Turks to an empty apartment because they had more than enough. And this went on for about a decade and a half, 80s and 90s. Anybody dealt with the Turks before, diplomatically, politically? Yes, you probably have. This is how they work. They're very nice. Very etiquette conscious, very protocol conscious, until you push them to the edge. And then they get really hard and snap. So this is what happened with Syria. For a decade and a half, the Syrians rejected Turkey's claims, well-founded, that he lived in Damascus. The Turks sent diplomatic delegations and ambassadors and their diplomats to tell the Syrians, this is not what good neighbors do. The Syrians denied. Then in 1998, the Turks said, all right, we have a new policy. They massed troops on their border with Syria. And Turkish newspapers came out with headlines, also referring to Turkey's then really good ties with the Israelis. If you think of the map, the Middle East, Turkey's here, there's Syria, there's Israel. So one country is to the south, one country is to the north. And the Turkish papers came out with a headline as Turkey was reportedly massing, I'm saying reportedly, I'll come to the minute, as Turkey was reportedly massing troops on its border with Syria, the Turkish papers came up with a headline that said, we are going to say shalom to the Israelis on the Golan Heights. Now, how can the Turks say shalom to the Israelis on the Golan Heights? This is Turkey, this is Syria, this is Israel. It means we're going to march through Syria tomorrow, and if you don't turn Öcalan in, the next day, literally, as Turkey had reportedly massed troops on the Syrian border, the Syrians said, oh, he lives here. We found him. They kicked him out. So pressure worked. Öcalan was then caught when he was on exile, going around in Kenya by Turkish troops, special ops, probably with U.S. assistance, because he used his cell phone, very stupid, if somebody's looking for you. And he was grabbed, brought to trial, and then he's in jail in Turkey now. But the gist of the story is that this changed Syria's behavior on Turkey. Syria stopped supporting the PKK and being its major provider, and started cooperating with Turkey to a very significant extent. So that, for example, if the Turks called the Syrians and said, we have evidence to believe that a PKK member is in Syria, the Syrians would arrest that guy and his cousins, and turn everybody to Turkey and say, you want our cooperation, here's our cooperation. So that really helped change Turkish-Syrian ties, and the AKP followed up on that, improved relations, trade, bilateral visits. Turkish-Syrian cabinets even started to hold joint strategic sessions until the Arab Spring started. The two countries lifted their visa restrictions for travel. The Turkish-Syrian border, which is Turkey's longest land border, 560 miles, became an open border. It was mined during the Cold War because Syria was with the Soviet Union, Turkey was with NATO, it was demined. So practically the two countries seemed like they were converging and getting together, and that was before the Arab Spring, and Turkey was also rising to the defense of Syria international politics. Yes?
Sir, doesn't Turkey occupy land claimed by Syria?
Yes, and this is the little enclave here. I wouldn't say occupy. This little enclave here, this is Turkey, this goes there. This is a little province. It's called Antakya. This is a Turkish name, but you might know it by its biblical name, Antia. This is a province of Turkey which was at the end of the Ottoman Empire. I'll make it very fast, but it's a story, important story. This was the Franco-Turkish armistice line at the end of the war, ceasefire line. Though because there was a Turkish community that lived in Antioch, also has Alexandrite in it, Anybody, this is in one of the Indiana Jones movies. That's where it starts. In Alexandria at the train station. So next time you see it, he's over there. Anyhow, there was a Turkish community that lived there. Turkey wanted autonomy for this community, even if it was to be left under French rule. The French said yes. Then, in the 1930s, as the Syrians wanted independence, the French decided that they would turn this independent, autonomous part of French-controlled Syria under French rule. And the Turks said, no, that's not the deal we had with you. They were supposed to have autonomy. And the French said, oh, what do we get in return? Turkey said, look, in the 1930s, wars start approaching, Hitler is rising, do you want us as an ally? The French said, yes. The Turks said, then we want Antioch. So they got it. It was a deal to get Turkey to stay out of the war and not get involved with the Nazis. Among other reasons, it worked. The Syrians never recognized this claim to the state. They claimed this province as theirs. So if you go to Syria one day, and if you see maps on around the country, you were going to see that the Syrian maps draw the country's borderline with Turkey to go north of the Antioch province. That was another issue that the Syrians were not happy with, one of the reasons why they supported the PKK against Turkey. But they supported primarily because this was the Cold War in the 80s. The Syrians were a client state of the Soviet Union. The Turks were our good friends. The Syrians wanted to hurt Turkey. So they used a proxy group to attack Turkey. In the end, they stopped supporting the PKK. The AKP started that process further, approached Syrians. As I said earlier, the two countries almost converged politically and economically, having joint cabinet sessions, lots of visits, no visas, free travel, free trade agreement, and that ended with the Syrian uprising, in the sense that Turkey's very intimate ties with Syria then were reconfigured. Turkey's ties with Iran and Iraq have also changed as a result of the Arab uprising. And they were very different only until about a year ago. As I said, if I was doing this lecture about a year ago, I would have said Turkey's really good friends with the Syrians and the Iranians, and that's something we should be looking into. Now the argument would be the opposite. It's that Turkey's ties with Syria are frayed, and so are its ties with Iran. What's going on with Iran and Iraq? With the Iranians, obviously, the big issue is Syria. Syria is a client state of Iran. Thrives on Iranian support, political and financial, because Syria gives Iran access to the Mediterranean and to Israel, which Iran would otherwise lack. One would even argue that because Syria is an ally of Iran, Iran therefore is a Levantine power that has access to the Mediterranean, so Iranians really care for their continued connections with the Syrian elite, and they have therefore stood with the Assad regime since the beginning of the uprising. What has Turkey done since the beginning of the uprising? It has not only criticized the Assad regime, as we have done and others have, but it has also started to support, host, and probably according to the media as well, are the Syrian opposition. There is something called the Free Syrian Army. This is mostly defectors from the Syrian army. Some of them are actively targeting the Syrian government inside the country. Some of them have fled north of the border into Turkey, and they are supposedly being trained and armed by Turkey. There was a news report about a couple of months ago which said that, quoting this colonel who says he's the head of the Syrian army, which said that they had about 5,000 to 10,000 people. I kind of thought it was an exaggerated number. I went about a year ago for a conference. There's a town here called Gaziantep. It's in southern Turkey. Can you guys read this in the back? This is a town on the border. It's Turkey's hub for trade with Iraq and Iran. It's also the home of baklava, so if you ever get an invitation to go there, go. It's very nice, good food. So I'm in Gaziantep, and what do? I can blend in with someone of Turkish origin and take care of a couple of people. I say, so what's this Free Syrian Army? It's like, do they really have 10,000 people? They say, no. Like, five? No. One? No. It's smaller. It's an enterprise. But the point is that an active opposition group, which is targeting the Assad regime, has a base in Turkey. So Turkey not only hosts the opposition, they have an opposition conference of peaceful groups, the Syrian National Council, that met in Istanbul and then also in other places, but they also are arming,
they are supporting armed opposition to the Syrian regime. That puts Turkey and Iran at the opposite ends of the spectrum on Syria policy. So, whereas until a few years ago, Turkey's Iran policy seemed to be friendly towards Iranians and not confront them on their nuclear policy, that has changed. Because the two countries now see each other competing for influence in Syria in such a way that it is a war to death. Either the Assad regime will win, and so will Iran, or the demonstrators will win, and so will Turkey. And they both know that, and I think that's why you could argue that long-term, the more Syria descends into chaos, the more Turkish-Iranian competition in Syria will get serious, and they might even back armed groups fighting one another, therefore really entering a war of proxy if Syria descends into a full-fledged civil war. So that's Turkish-Iranian relations, definitely configured very, where we could say more of a conflict-ridden relationship than a peaceful one. So is Turkish-Syrian relationship, because when Syria started to crack down on the opposition, this is when Turkey-Syria policy changed. Remember I said, for the last 10 years, since the Syrians kicked out of Jalan in 98, Turkish-Syrian ties improved, trade, bilateral ties. Believe it or not, Turkey even signed a treaty to train Syrian military and police as a NATO ally. People were saying, this is really far-fetched, but it never happened because when the uprising in Syria started, Turkey stood against the regime's crackdown. Said, you know, called us out, said you should not be killing people. And at that time, Turkey's foreign minister, his name is Davutoğlu. You've heard about him, you'll hear about him. By the way, this is a letter in Turkish, which has a little accent mark over it, like the Czech, Hacek. When you see that mark, it means that G's silent. So you don't say it. So this is how you say it. I just said So Davutoğlu is Turkey's foreign minister. He is the grandfather of AKP's foreign policy. Zero problems with neighbors. He's the one who came and said, we got to make really good friends. We're all allies. Turkey can become a regional power only if it has good ties with everybody, Iranians and Syrians. And I was one of the critics of the policy. I said, do not care for the nature of the regimes, just making friends with dictators. He did not, obviously, but I think the Arab Spring has taught him a lesson that the friendship that he had named with Assad was a friendship with Assad and not with the Syrian people. Because he was thinking he was making friends with the Syrian people. In fact, he was making friends with their dictator. And he was, I think that lesson was exposed to him when he traveled to Damascus at the beginning of the Syrian uprising. Supposedly, this was when he would tell Assad to stop. And remember, because Assad had been such a good friend of him, and he had so much leverage over Syria, because the two countries had joined sessions of their cabinets, Assad would listen to him. Did Assad listen to him? No. 6 hours after Davutoğlu left Damascus, he sent tanks into Hama. He's basically saying, you know what, I don't care about what you do because my Iranian friends are supporting me. And you were never my friend, I just acted like you were. And I think he realized he was taken for a ride. So Turkish anger on Syria became even more public. Turkey was the first country, therefore, to call for Assad to step down. And so first country, which basically said they cannot live with an Assad-ruled Syria. And this is why I suggested earlier, it's kind of war to death between Turkey and Syria. Turkey is, of all the countries in the region, and around the world, including us, a lot of them can come to terms with living with an Assad on Syria if he manages to crack down on the uprising. Turkey cannot. They already called him horrible names, called him to step down, called him a dictator. Armed opposition to him supported it, and therefore I think Turkey will do everything, and we can discuss it in Q&A to make sure that it goes and steps down, and that includes perhaps even likely, you know, buffer zones and no-fly zones and others that we can look. So Iranian, Turkish-Iranian ties and Turkish-Syrian ties have collapsed both at the same time, have changed as a result of the Arab Spring. This, as I said, sometimes really good things can come out of unexpected events, and I would say this is the silver lining of the Arab Spring for us. It's rather positive in terms of our ties with the Turks. Yes?
Should I hold a question about what Syria is doing with respect to the Kurds?
Yeah, later. I'll come to that. Just coming up. Thank you. Just as Turkish ties with Syria have changed, Turkish ties with Iran have changed. Iran now sees Turkey as a main competitor, and it sees it as a threat, because if Turkey's Syria policy works, Iran will lose Syria,
it will cease to be a Levantine power, and it will have no more influence in Lebanon or on the Israeli front. So for them, this is huge. They lose lots of hegemony in a part of the world where they love to have power and influence. And so let's go back to Turkey. Only last year, Turkey announced that it would, after many deliberations and much consideration and skepticism on the Turkish side, they announced that they would join NATO's missile defense project by placing radars on Turkish territory as part of this project. Is it shocking? It would have been really shocking before the Arab Spring, because this is not how Turkey looked at things. They said, Iran's nukes, that's not our problem, that's your problem. And we're not going to support a project that looks like it's against Iranians because they are good friends. But that was before the Arab Spring started. Now they're saying, those Iranians, they are a threat. Because, you know, we want different things with them in Syria, and also they want different things with them in Iraq. You've seen how sectarian tensions in Iraq have surfaced after the U.S. withdrawal of Kuwait troops. The Shiite majority government has started to crack down on the Sunni majority parties. The vice president of Iraq, who is the leader of the Sunni community, has fled to northern Iraq, which is a Kurdish-run area, for safe haven. So in Iraq, there's obviously a sectarian overlay, political split that is emerging. I wouldn't say emerging, I think it's a fault line that was always there. It's surfacing. And this fault line, Turkey and Iran are once again, I guess, in opposite camps. Iran is with the Shiite majority parties, including Dava party of the Prime Minister Maliki. And Turkey is with the more pan-Iraqi movements, as well as with the Sunni groups, including Vice President Hashemi, who's now in northern Iraq. So in Iraq as well, there's Turkish-Iranian competition, and I think this is also shaping Turkish-Iranian relations, as well as Turkish-Iraqi relations. The PKK, which used to have bases in Syria from where it was kicked out, also had bases in Iran, by the way, and those bases were shut down too. So I'm kind of going back to the PKK issue, but it's important. Why would Iran, which supported the PKK as a terrorist group against Turkey for decades, allowing to launch attacks into Turkey from its territory, suddenly start cracking down on the PKK? I'll give you the date and you'll know the answer. Iran started cracking down on the PKK in March 2003. It's the Iraq War. The moment we launched the Iraq War, Iranians are saying, I'll draw it, you know, very hypothetical map. This is Iran. This is Iraq. This is Afghanistan. Iranians are saying, oh, somebody's making an Iranian sandwich. U.S. troops in Iraq, U.S. troops in Afghanistan. And what do they say? We have to break this, you know, grip of U.S. military presence forming around us. After this, the Gulf to the south, the Caucasus to the north, they were encircled. How do they break it? Gotta win one ally in this chain around us, and that's Turkey. So Iranian-Turkish ties changed immediately as soon as the Iraq War started, only because of pure strategic considerations. Iranians, which had provided the PKK with bases on their territory for decades, started bombing the PKK bases, which they had set up as soon as the war started, because they're saying now, the benefits of winning Turkey as a friend and breaking the grip of U.S. isolation military presence forming around us outweigh the past benefits of hurting Turkey through supporting a terrorist group that targeted. Why would Iranians have targeted Turkey? Because if you think of it, among Muslim majority countries, Iran and Turkey are probably the two most opposed in terms of their political regimes. Turkey is a secular democracy, Iran is an authoritarian neo-theocracy. So they're very different. Iran hated Turkey, it's the antidote to what Iran wants to be, and they wanted to use this group, PKK and others, to hurt the Turks. But that policy stopped in 2003 because they said, you know, we have Americans to the east, to the west, to the south, to the north, we need one ally, the best ally who can win is Turks, because what is the very basic lesson of how Turks view their Middle East neighbors, I told you in the beginning? PKK issue. If you help the PKK against the Turks, you are their best friend. If you help the PKK against the Turks, then you're their enemy. So they went from being enemy to best friend overnight. And it really is that simple. You could see a country that the Turks love because that country helps Turkey against PKK. The The next day, there's evidence that that country is doing the opposite. Their policy will switch, and it switched significantly in 2003, and it stayed like that until this, it's beginning of the Arab Spring. I'll come to you later, sir. When the Arab Spring started, the Iranians and Turks oppose each other on Syria, right? One of them supports the regime, one of them supports the opposition. And the Iranians said, how can we get the Turks to change their behavior? How can we punish them? How can we show them that there's something they'll pay if they confront us in Syria and might even cause us to lose our Syrian ally and access to the Mediterranean? Suddenly, there was a large PKK attack into Turkey that killed 24 Turkish troops. That's only a couple of months ago. Surprisingly large, there was not an attack of this size. There's not been one since the early 1990s. I have reason to believe, not corroborated entirely, that Iranians are now encouraging the PKK to once again attack Turkey, not from Iran, because, you know, Middle East politics, you don't do direct war proxy, but from Iraq, where the PKK has bases. So Iran is now saying it's not us, but it's the PKK. But obviously, I think the group is doing this because it feels Iranian encouragement and backing. So it's once again in the picture. The Turks are seeing this being Iranian encouragement of PKK attacks into Turkey, and that's making Iran an enemy in their eyes once again. Add to this Turkish-Iranian competition in the Middle East, in Iraq and in Syria, so we can really talk about an entirely reconfigured set of relationships between Turkey and its three Middle Eastern neighbors. They went from being very good to being extremely, extremely negative in terms of Turkish-Syrian ties, and a trend of deterioration in terms of Turkish-Iranian ties. This is the first part of what I want to talk about, is how Turkey's foreign policy changed under the AKP with Davutoğlu's vision of zero problems, and it changed again after the Arab Spring in a rather unexpected, but also opposite direction, with the Turks perceiving a lot of threat from Iranians getting involved in Syria, and also the PKK issue again becoming a wedge issue between them and Iranians. That explains, for example, to a large part, Turkey's commitment to the NATO missile defense project. Because now they're looking at their neighborhoods, they're saying, we're not that safe. These guys wanted to make friends with, they're actually our friends, and so Iranian nuclear issue is now a threat for them. A year ago, they would have said that's not their problem. So I expect them to do even more, I think, in terms of coming on board with their NATO commitment, and that's all very good news. There was a question in the back? Yes.
You mentioned in 03, Iran and Turkish became more allied based on their Iranian decision with the PKK. Is that the primary reason why Turkish did not allow the United States to establish the Northern Front?
No, I think that came after, meaning Iranian support for the PKK ended when the war started. The Turks stopped, you know, did not allow us to go in before that. It was in the year before 2002, and that's got a lot of reasons, one of which I think that the government, AKP, which had just come to power, did not like the whole Iraq war idea. Thought of it in a different way when we did. They saw it as an attack on a Muslim country. They did not want to be part of it. And the government, having roots in Turkey's Islamist opposition, obviously had an ideological take off the war, saying, you know, whatever the reasons, the United States should not go into a Muslim country. It might be justified, it's not justified in their eyes. And they said no. And I think that that there was a vote that was taken in the Turkish parliament to allow the use, Turkey's territory for sending our troops into Iraq. The vote failed. Now, so far what I've said sounds makes sense. It's a democracy, they have a parliament, they vote, the vote fails. If in a parlamentary democracy, which is different than ours, if in a parliamentary democracy, a government decides on something and it sends that decision to the parliament, how likely is it that the vote fails if the government stands behind it? Zero. Because in parliamentary democracies, governments are elected from the very parliament, which they then control. There is no separation of power between the legislative branch and the executive branch, as we do. So if the government sends a decision to the parliament, and the government has a majority in the parliament, that's why it's the government. It has a majority in the parliament as the governing party. If it sends a decision, it's basically telling the parliament, just put your rubber stamp on here. And if deputies don't vote with the government's decision, Then there is a tool called, it's called whipping, it's from, probably from 19th century British parliamentary democracy. Those deputies that don't vote along with the government's decision in the parliament are kicked out of the party, they're whipped. Not physically, of course, but they're punished, they lose their seats. In Turkey, when the government sent this vote to the parliament in 2003, March, it said, we're sending a decision to the majority of the parliamentarians who belong to the governing party, AP, and it said, you can vote as you like. So it left them free, which means they never wanted it, they kind of wanted a way out, and their way out was to send this to the parliament and blame it on parliamentary vote. So that was, I think, the real reason it didn't happen. To come back today, though, that process, which started a rift between us and the Turks, I think came to an end for a variety of reasons. One is, in 2007, the United States started helping Turkey against the PKK, against PKK presence in Iraq, which was very significant because how do the Turks see their neighbors? Help them or help the PKK? There is no halfway. And as soon as we started helping the Turks against PKK by sharing intelligence with them in 2007, that changed the tenor of Turkish-US relations, improved it significantly. And the Arab Spring has only made it much more positive because we have similar policies in Iraq, in Iran, and in Syria. So you will see a general sense of improvement in Turkish-US ties since 2007, since cooperation started on the PKK issue. But that improvement really took off in 2010 when the Arab Spring started, when Turks started saying, we have similar interests and policies when it comes to Iraq, Iran, and Syria with the Americans. And then they also start to say, and we really need to be serious about NATO. Because, you know, after all, this is an organization that can help us with security. So that's what I wanted to talk about as an introduction to give you an idea about Turkey's doubly transformed foreign policy. Transformed after the AKP and transformed after the Arab Spring. Any questions thus far? Yes.
Tell us about the significance of President Obama, in the sense of deputizing Erdogan, is that correct?
Yeah, Erdogan. There is an element of that too.
To pick the leaders, the Islamist leaders of the Free Syria Army.
I think they talk about a little bit the Obama-Erdogan relationship, the president's quite close ties to Turkish leader Erdogan, who was the leader of the AKP and Turkey's prime minister, chief executive. So this is, again, a silent G, that's why it's Erdogan. One of the ways I think our ties with the Turks have really changed in the last year, and then I will come to Turkey's position as a model for the Arab Spring, kind of to look at the Arab countries now, after looking at Turkish foreign policy, and then we'll stop over and then take some questions and comments as well. In 2010, June, I would say that was probably one of the low points of Turkish-US relationship in the last decade. If after, of course, the March 2003 vote, you know, that's the vote when the Turkish parliament said no to the war, that was another low point. Things were bad. 2007, we started helping the Turks against PKK, they improved. 2010, another improvement. One reason is the Arab Spring. Another reason is that the president decided in 2010 that he would just have a really heart-to-heart conversation with the Turkish prime minister to talk about Turkey's foreign policy, which at that time seemed to take issue with the U.S. on Iran, Iraq, and Syria, and Israel, Palestine. Turkey voted no against U.S.-sponsored sanctions at the U.N. Security Council in June 2007. I said that was a big shock. A lot of people anticipated, not myself included. I was basically saying they're going to vote no, because I was talking to Turks and saying, what are you going to do? Are you going to abstain from the vote? They're saying, no, we'll just vote no. Because back then they did not think of Iran as a threat, they thought of it as somebody else's problem. So they voted no at the UN Security Council on Iran sanctions. It was a shock because people said, the Turks? They said, you know, maybe the Russians and the Chinese, but the Turks are allies. How can a NATO ally lobby against U.S. policy that we've been trying to build for the last 2 years, getting the Russians to agree with us, getting the Chinese to agree with us, and the Turks, it's not only, they did not simply not just abstain, they voted against it. So the reaction was, I think, what do we do? There were two policies suggested. One was, give them a hard time, because they've gone against core US interests. Cut Erdogan out. Don't see him, don't talk to him. Another one, I think, that the president favored was, go to him and have a really candid conversation with him. That happened, I believe, it was reported in the media also, at the G20 summit in Toronto, July 2010. So the president sits, and I'm going to draw this. This will make sense. This is I was told how we're sitting in the room with the configuration. There is President Obama sitting. There is Erdogan, Prime Minister, and there is Davutoğlu, Foreign Minister. He's looking at him, but talking to him. He's saying, Mr. Prime Minister, while looking at the Foreign Minister, saying, I'm really upset with your government. So he's basically telling Davutoğlu, the chief architect of Turkey's foreign policy, including the zero problems with neighbors, get along with the wrong policy. It's you, I know. Stop. I think that was made clear to Erdogan that Davutoğlu's policy is a liability when it comes to Turkey's ties with the US, and maybe Turkey should reconsider what it has been doing on Iran. That was the beginning of the end of Turkey's policy to support Iran's nukes. You can go Google this, it's incredible. Until July Toronto meeting, Turkey basically every week, Erdogan or Davutoğlu say something about how Iranians have the right to nuclear research because they're not making a bomb. If they were making a bomb, that would not be Turkey's problem. And if there was a problem about a bomb, it's Israel's bomb. They were repeating these sentences. After July 2010, you cannot find one comment Erdogan or Davutoğlu made in support of Iranian nuclearization. That conversation, I think, was so severe but also straightforward that it helped. People suggest that it also brought forward a personal relationship between Erdogan and President Obama, so that they talk quite often now. Someone in the White House said recently that Erdogan gets more phone calls than the British Prime Minister does. You know what that means? Erdogan gets the most phone calls for any head of foreign state from the White House. And probably likes it. So he probably therefore decides not to, or tries not to step too much out of line with US policy. So that's one more reason. I wouldn't say it is the reason, but I would say it's one more reason that has helped Turkey align with the US on Iran, Iraq, and Syria. But the real reason is the Arab Spring. So much instability, also showing to Turkey that its zero problem with NATO's policy has failed, that Turkey now decides once again to take NATO and its alliance with the US seriously. This brings us to the next point, the other side of the Turkish border with the Arab world. What's happening in Syria, Egypt, and Tunisia, and other countries? To what extent is Turkey a model? Where does Turkey teach us lessons that we can take across, and where does Turkey teach us lessons that we should avoid? I think it goes both ways, and that goes to a discussion of Turkish domestic politics in the last 10 years. The Rule of Justice and Development Party, AKP. When this party came to power in 2002, as I said, I just want to make sure you guys are listening. there were a lot of concerns raised. Some people said it's an Islamist party, it's going to change Turkey's policy, and it did. It changed Turkey's foreign policy for almost a decade after making a full circle and coming back, because realizing that what they wanted to do, what Davutoğlu wanted to pursue, becoming good friends with Iranians and Syrians, was wishful thinking but not realistic. But that also means we have to look at what happened in Turkey internally to see to what extent all that presents a model. One of the things that has happened in Turkey is that this governing party, which is rooted in Turkey's opposition, ran against Turkey's established elites in foreign policy, including its very powerful military, which once upon a time used to be the kingmaker in Ankara. And all of that has ended. All of that meaning the role of the military in Turkish politics, and the fact that the AKP represented an opposition movement to the contrary, it is now the new elite of the country. Turkey has a very large presence of government-controlled media, for example. Some of it is actually owned by government interests. There's a large media group whose CEO is the prime minister's son-in-law. only 1 degree of separation. They have made amendments to the constitution so that they can appoint all judges to the high courts without a confirmation process, similar to what's happening in Hungary, if you're following that. Any Hungarians here? Also, they have gone after the military, using allegations of a coup plot, suggesting that the military was trying to overthrow the government through the use of this gang called Ergenekon. When it started in 2007, a lot of people said, probably true, because Turkey has a tradition of coups. It's not the first time that this would have happened, and it's good that the government is going after possible coup plotters. I was talking to people who said, might be the case, this doesn't look like it. Might be meaning, yes, the military has carried out coups, maybe they were doing it, but not this one. Because the people they arrested were put in jail, and then they prepared an indictment, which had no evidence to say that there was a coup plot. The indictment is a very long one, by the way, it's 5,000 pages and on. And I have a friend who says it's intentionally long and has evidence that has nothing to do with the case included in it. So it's obfuscating and convoluted, and it's in legal Turkish. Anyone read legal Turkish? It's like legal German.
Oh,
sentences are like 2 pages long. So you, and the verb is at the end. That's how Turkish is. So you have to read the whole thing, and then you get to be like, what is it? So it's a very difficult case for us to put our fingers on. But the bottom line is this. Yes, Turkey has a tradition of the military overthrowing governments. Maybe that was the case. Maybe not. But the indictment of the Ergenekon case has no evidence to suggest that this was actually happening, other than saying that there is a coup plot. It's such a good coup plot, the prosecutors cannot find it yet. I'm not making this up. But it is used as evidence to arrest more people through ongoing rounds, including a very large percentage of Turkey's top brass, as well as a lot of former military, and later on journalists, university presidents, scholars, activists. So now Turkey has more journalists in jail than China and Iran. It's a democracy, but obviously there's a paradox in there, in the sense that the government has used this court case to go after its opponents in what looks like an undemocratic fashion, or maybe that's a tough word, in a fashion that does not necessarily respect rule of law. There's no due process. No one arrested as a result of the case, which started in 2007, has yet had a verdict come down. So that's 5 years and going on. They've been in jail for 5 years. This is indefinite incarceration. And the indictment is not complete. The court case goes on. In the Turkish court system, an indictment has to be read in full and debated in full before the judges can make a decision. How many pages is this thing? 5,000 in legal Turkish. So you can imagine it takes forever. The court meets once a month. Every time they meet about 100 pages. And the case goes on, but what it has done is it has created a sense of intimidation over anyone who opposes the government and its policies, including the military, to say that you too might be targeted by what appears to be an open-ended case if you go against this government. As a result, the Turkish military went from speaking up against the government and its policies and foreign policy to becoming quiet, and now I would say to folding in or snapping. There was a round of high-profile resignations last summer. Do you guys remember? August. Turkey has what's called the Military Promotions Board every twice a year. The August one is the big one. That's when people are made generals. Just a few days before that, the entire top brass resigned. It's basically their way of saying, we throw in the towel, government wins, we are no more going to challenge you. And I think that was the end of Turkey's unique configuration of politics, where the military was someone that the government felt like they had to listen to. That is no more the case. The Turkish military remains what it is. It's powerful, it's big, it's secular in its origin, but it will not challenge this government ever again. So Turkey's period of military government confrontations are over. It's a good thing overall because, you know, we'd like the military to work under civilian authority. But it's not entirely a positive picture because the way it has happened has created a sense of intimidation for anyone who disagrees with the government that they might be targeted by an open-ended case. And this is kind of, I think, where we leave the debate and go back to the Arab world. So if you see the rise of Islamist parties in Arab countries, and if you see them go after their opponents through the use of methods such as the Erdogan case, I think the lesson of that is do Islamist parties moderate? And what happens when Islamist parties come to power, be it democratically? Turkey answers gives answers to both of those questions. The first is Islamist parties moderate. The second is until they come to power. The third is that their moderation remains if there are strong checks and balances, democratic or outside interests. In Turkey, the first part happened, Islamist parties moderated. The AKP came to power in 2002 primarily because it jettisoned its Islamist rhetoric and moving to the center. What is Islamism in Turkey? I'll probably talk for another 5 minutes and it will end. What's Islamism in Turkey? Islamism in Turkey is, thank God, it's not violent, but it is largely an ideology that never recognized democracy, and that was always anti-American, its foreign policy instincts, and this is what the AKP's predecessors were, and it's also what Erdogan, the Prime Minister, stood for in the 1990s. The Islamist Party came to government in a brief coalition, came to power in a brief coalition government in the mid-1990s. Turkey's then secular-dominated Supreme Court shut down this party, said Turkey has a secular constitution, and your activities are violating that constitution, and it was shut down. The Islamist Party said, oh, you can shut us down, we're gonna re-establish under a different name. Turkey shut down the second Islamist Party as well. The Islamist Party said, shut us down, we're gonna re-establish ourselves, same cadre, same ideology, under a third different name. Turkey shut that down. The lesson for the Islamists in Turkey was, oh, this is not gonna work. If you want to come to power, you need to play it by the games, jettison some of the rhetoric, but also move to the center so you can get more centrist votes. If you do opinion polls in Turkey, you'll find out that typically if you ask questions, and the question is, do you want Sharia law to be implemented? About 50 to 20% of the Turks say yes. Today, that's the case, that was the case 10 years ago, it hasn't changed. And about 80% say no. There are two ways of looking at this. One is to say, my God, that means one out of every six Turks is an Islamist. The way I look at it is to say five out of every six is no. I can live with that because, you know, the broader majority is not with them. So this Islamism was never a mainstream ideology. And the party realized that it had to moderate not only to avoid the court shutting it down, but also to move to the center. So it jettisoned its rhetoric and said, we're just a conservative movement. We don't want Sharia law, we're not radicals. It helped to them that in 2001, Turkey had a massive economic crisis. Its economy melted down, very similar to what we had here, even worse. Unemployment went up to 20% in a matter of a year. And the traditional secular party, which had run the country for decades, all happened to be in government at the time of the financial crisis. They were voted out, as would be in many countries, for they were seen responsible for the economic meltdown. That's when the AKP came forth and said, try us. You see how it's kind of the perfect storm that brings them to power. The court forces them to moderate. They decide that they have to jettison their rhetoric so they won't be shut down again. And also it's a good thing in a democracy, if you move to the center, you get more votes. At the same time, their competition is imploding. The typical parties that run Turkey are being voted out because they're seen as responsible for the country's worst economic crisis in modern history. So the AKP came to power in 2002 as a result of these dynamics, and they were moderate in their rhetoric for a very long time until they came up with this court case where they realized that they had been in power long enough that they could start to go after their opposition. So there is no more independent judiciary in Turkey at the moment. It's hard to speak of that. All members of the high courts are appointed by the government without a confirmation process. They are the prime minister's men and women. At the same time, the media is largely under government control. Independent media has been bought by government watchdogs and sold to government supporters. And when you don't have independent media, it's really hard to speak of a functioning liberal democracy. You might have elections, but only one side of the political line is going to be represented. That's the government's line. So Turkey's lessons are that, you know, Islamist parties are perfectly capable of moderating. But that once they moderate, when they come to power, the Turkish example, at least in this case, shows us that that moderation can easily turn into unmoderation. They can easily go back to authoritarianism and cracking down on opposition, getting rid of checks and balances, and also pursuing a foreign policy that is antithetical to U.S. interests. In Turkey, that foreign policy part has been reconfigured because the Arab Spring has created such volatility in Turkey's neighborhood that the government has decided for the time being that they should better work with us. I would even argue that Turkey's foreign policy today falls somewhere where it was in the 90s and where it was in the last decade. This is 2012, somewhere in between. Why? Because in the 90s, Turkey was a staunch U.S. ally. They were with us on everything, NATO, Balkans. In the last decade, they were opposing us on many issues, Iran, Syria, Arab Israeli. Now they're with us on the Arab Spring, which is the chief foreign policy problem in their neighborhood because they have similar concerns, they fear instability, they fear Iran. So I think the picture is one in which, you know, we have lots of good foreign policy cooperation, but this is not to say it will last forever. It's not permanent because it's no more, it being foreign policy cooperation, it's no more driven by a sense of common destiny, as the case was in the 90s, belonging to common institutions, such as NATO, having deep-rooted common interests. But rather, a short-term, you know, we have to work with the Americans now because they're our best bet in the region, given the Iranian threat. It could easily change tomorrow, let's say, if Syria has a revolution, it has a new government, that government decides to be an Islamist one, and the AKP government is not going to not like that, and we're not going to be happy with that, and so we could easily see problems emerging. So I would say we've seen a country dramatically transformed in the last 10 years. This is no more your mother's Turkey, pun intended, in the sense that it's no more a country whose gut reaction is to work with the United States, but it's a country that now works with us on an ad hoc basis. And the ad hoc thing is the Arab Spring, and Turkey's ability to present itself as a model for the Arab Spring has, it's a two-way street. Yes, it shows that Islamist parties moderate, but also that they moderate because there are checks and balances which force them to. Once those checks and balances are eliminated, they are easily likely to unmoderate, and I think that's the Turkish lesson. Why did I stop here? I've covered so much, I understand, but I want to really bring you both up to speed on Turkish politics, Arab Spring, and also kind of where we stand with the Turks, and also what the future holds. I welcome any questions and comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before we start the Q&A session, we have an announcement from the back. Please, Stephanie Kramer, who works for our Observer Project, has an announcement.
That was an awesome presentation.
Thank you, Stephanie.
And I'd like to invite you all to another awesome set of presentations, which will be happening January 31st, that's a Tuesday, and it will be on the subject of motivations to acquire or develop nuclear weapons. We're going to have panelists talking about those countries that could have gone nuclear but decided not to, convinced not to, countries that have and countries that might. So I'm going to go upstairs and grab some more flyers, but all of the information is right here. And it will be here in the GRC, free, everybody can come.
Thank you. And for us, the next session of our Arab Spring lectures will be on the 7th of February. Same time, same place. It will be on the country of Yemen, an Arab country, actually one of the oldest Arab countries. The speaker will be Dr. Christopher Swift. If you're not a member, meaning you don't have our mailing list, please see Adam Seitz right there to the left, and we will send you the announcement, and you're all welcome. And as the chair, I know you have a question that I have you on my list. If I could ask the first question, which actually is a two-part question, partially relates to what our next conference is. Number one, one country did not mention much was Israel.
Okay.
I know you said in your talk here that our relationship with Turkey is somewhere in the middle of what it was in the 90s and what it was now in 2012. You kind of mentioned Arab-Israeli issue, but I'm talking directly about Israeli-Turkish relationship from a strategic perspective to humiliating each other in public. Where are we standing now? And related to that partially is this conference we have about these issues. Like, if, let us say, a country such as Iran goes nuclear,
right.
I know this is not a long-term answer to what you think a response from Turkey might be. Thank you.
I can start with the second one, shorter answer, and the first one being a little bit of background. If I know the Turks, I think they're probably already making plans for Iranian nuclearization. One plan was short-term, get on their missile defense shield. Second is they're probably looking around saying, where can we get the bomb? I'm not saying they're making it, but they're probably actively searching for ways to make sure they have their plan B if the Iranians get a bomb. I think the nuclear proliferation in the Middle East as a result of Iranian nuclearization is most likely the case of Saudis and Turks. The Saudis will buy it, the Turks will make it. That's how it goes in the Middle East. The Turks are builders, not thinkers.
I can say that.
Is this on the gonna be on the public or
not? Erase it.
Right. So, come on, you go around the Ottoman Empire, everywhere there's a mosque or a church or a soup kitchen or a library they have built, right? From the Balkans to the Middle East. How many Ottoman philosophers do you know? They really don't. They're good. Okay. Anyhow. They'll build it. They make the bomb, they look for it, they'll try to get it, don't know where, but I think they're already making plans. That's plan B, that's long term. Short term, obviously, was to say, gotta get into missile defense because the Iranians are making a bomb, they're serious, and they are a threat. The Turkeys are a part of these liberal backgrounds, which is that Turkey's ties with Israel were quite good until the rise of the AKP in 2002. I talked about how Turkey and Israel were together against Syria, when Syria supported the PKK and hosted its leader, Öcalan. One reason why the two countries really came together is that they historically had good ties. Turkey was the first Muslim-majority country to recognize Israel in 1949. It was the only country of Muslim-majority that had ties with the Israelis until Camp David, when Israel made peace with Egypt. And you can always tell Israeli peace with Egypt was not a real peace. So Turkey was the only Muslim-majority country that had normal, public, diplomatic, powerful ties with Israel. It included trade, commerce, tourism, academic exchanges, friendly policies, and military and security cooperation. The Israelis modernized Turkish military hardware in the 90s. The Turks had a difficult time in the 90s to buy weapons from us. Anytime they wanted to buy something to use it against the PKK, they'd be blocked on the hill. Because they go against Armenian and Greek lobbies, less so now with the Greeks, but the Armenian lobby issue continues to be a problem for them. So they would go around to congressional blockade, and they would go to the Israelis and say, oh, can you sell this to us? Because we need it. And the Israelis would happily share that with the Turks, because they needed allies and friends, and the Turks were a rare ally in a tough neighborhood. The Israelis consider Turkey to be their second best friend after the United States. This is, you know, from Israeli military security officials, as they would say to the media. So you can imagine how intimate that relationship was. It all changed in 2002. Just like our ties with the Turks changed when the AKP, which is rooted in Islamism, came to power, so did their ties with the Israelis. And I think that's largely driven by an anti-Israeli and at the same time anti-Semitic worldview. And remember I said earlier, Islamism. What is Islamism? It's not about religion. It's about an ideology, and I wanted to kind of really make that point. I can tell you a brief anecdote. I wrote an opinion piece a couple of years ago in the Wall Street Journal, and Dr. Charles is here, so I'll mention it. It's about one of your relatives. This is about the last Ottoman caliph who died in New York City. When he died in 2009, Yeah, he passed away. I wrote an op-ed piece about his death and the funeral. He was buried in Istanbul. By the way, he's a U.S. citizen. The caliph is a U.S. citizen, right? So he wants to be buried in Istanbul because that's his ancestors are buried. His ancestors are the Ottoman sultans. They're all buried in big imperial tombs and all of that. So he wants to be buried there, he's buried there. His funeral, who shows up? Bunch of Islamists in Taliban outfit who chant to bring the caliph back. And when I saw that, I said, that's not right. I wrote a piece, I titled it, I Want My Caliph Back. And I wrote about it, I said, you know, Islamism is an ideology which distorts religion, but also claims to drive legitimacy from religion and tries to recruit from Muslims and stand for Islam, but it really is not Islam. Here's the evidence. The caliph who died, I said, Islamists in Taliban outfit and jihadists showed up to celebrate him or to mourn him, not knowing that the caliph who died was an American citizen who lived in Upper East Side in New York, drank scotch, listened to Wagner, and was married to a South African Jew. Not Muslims. So, but that's not what Islamists are saying. They're taking this guy's reality. It's not what they are. He would have kicked them out if he lived in Istanbul. He's the opposite of what they stand for, but nevertheless distorting the reality and then broadcasting it as reality, I think, is what Islamists do masterfully. This is how they switch and twist at the same time in terms of getting their message out. The Islamists in Turkey are broadcasters of a twisted message, and their twisted message always was that they don't like the United States, they don't like Israel, they don't like the European Union, they don't like democracy, they don't like secularism. Basically, the line of thinking, it would be offensive, so I'm going to quote it, is that they don't like Jews, and Jews live in Israel, so they don't like Israel. Quote unquote, Jews run the United States, and the United States is bad. So I think all these things are very much linked in the Islamist mindset. And when the Turkish Islamists came to power, although they had moderated, jettisoned that rhetoric, they were not saying any of this anymore, you could argue that, well, that doesn't mean they didn't believe it. They were not just using it for propaganda, because the court was shutting them down, and that message does not resonate with 80% of the Turks. So they were not saying it, but it's not to say they would not implement it. And I think one area where they implemented their unpronounced thinking was in terms of Turkey's ties with Israel. Those ties unraveled as soon as the AKP came to power, just as our ties with Turks went through a very difficult phase. But their ties with Israel went through even a more difficult phase. Turkish-Israeli military cooperation started to go down. The Israelis suddenly stopped getting contracts from the Turks for military modernization, for no reason. And a lot of people said, oh, it's not a big deal, they still have military ties going on and commerce going on. But then things started to get really ugly when the AKP government adopted the Hamas issue in Gaza as its chief project. And I'm not saying they adopted the Palestinian cause. Rather, they adopted the Hamas' presence and stance in Gaza, and they started to say it's a legitimate group. This is what represents the Palestinian people. You have to talk to them, ignoring and dismissing the secular Palestinian authority of Hamas. Why are they doing this? Because Hamas, too, is an Islamist movement, party, which shares a lot of their worldview. Hamas is saying it. AKP is not. Hamas is violent. AKP is not. But there is a certain amount of ideological affinity. It will be the similarity between a socialist party and a communist party in the Cold War. AKP will be the socialist party. Saying we're not going to use violence, we'll run elections, and Hamas is the communist one, which is saying we're going to overthrow through use of violence. A rough analogy, bad one perhaps, but I think makes sense to show where they stand political to one another. And that was the beginning of the end of Turkish-Israeli ties, when Turkey indexed its foreign policy with Israel to Israel's Hamas policy. Turkey said, no, we're going to treat you based on how you deal with Hamas. Israelis not only put a blockade on Gaza, but considered Hamas as a terrorist group, targeted it, and that was the deterioration of Turkish-Israeli ties. Its epitome came, I would say, in 2008, when Turkey kicked Israelis out of this Air Force exercise called Anatolian Eagle. It's held in Turkish on Turkish airspace every year. We go, the Israelis go, the Turks go, it's under NATO auspices. It's supposed to help everybody train, but really the Israelis, because Israelis really cannot train over Israeli airspace because it's so tiny. So they need a large airspace, Turkish to train. The Turks kicked them out in 2008. What are they telling the Israelis by kicking them out of an Air Force training exercise? If the Israeli fighter pilots or bomber pilots are training, what are they training for? Iran. They're basically saying, we're not going to help you against Iran, get out of here. I think that was the sign of the end of the military cooperation, and the public part of it became visible to us during this, what's called the flotilla incident. Turkey's government sponsored the flotilla of ships that was supposed to get aid to Gaza, which is under blockade. So far, so good, it looks humanitarian, except the guys on board the ship, which the government let sail, were people who were posting, as they were on the ship, if you look this online, posting blogs saying they're ready to die. They're going on a mission. So this is not an humanitarian mission. They're not going there to bring in medical assistance. They're basically going for confrontation. The Israelis walked into a trap. They boarded the ships, you know, in a wrong fashion, probably don't want to use helicopters. There are people there with you know, baseball bats waiting to hit you, and some of their guys captured. They started firing. They killed 9 Turks. That was the public and bookend of the Turkish-Israeli ties. Now there's blood. The government has not stepped back from it, AKP. The Israelis have also taken a hard line. That was kind of the status quo until the Arab Spring started. I love the Arab Spring because it's done a lot of good things for us. Because one of the issues is that the Arab Spring led Turkey to see that Iran is a threat and Syria is not a friend, and that the United States is their best bet. Short term as it is, better than nothing. But the other part of it is that the Arab Spring has shown to the Turks the Israelis are not their enemies. It's not their security concern. They may not like them, they may not like what they do with Hamas, but Israel is not a security threat to Turkey. Turkey's biggest security threats are Iran, Iran's nukes, and uprising and rebellion and likely civil war in Syria. So secretly, it's almost as if they want to make up with the Israelis, and I know this because often stays in this room between friends. Every week I get a phone call from a think tank in town which wants to set up a track tool with the Israelis, and they're saying, can you suggest us some names? I can see there's a lot of interest in setting up, you know, track two, and there's a lot of track two going on. It means, you know, people are saying, let's just find ways and background channels to make up. My nickname is not track two, so I get a lot of it. But I think it shows you there's a hope of improvement in Turkish-Israeli ties. It's not going to go back to where it was in the 90s, not under the current Turkish government, and probably not under the current Israeli government. It's an emotional scar for both of them, what happened in the last few years, including the flotilla incident. You know, they fought each other. Indirectly, as it might be, so this is not going to be the cozy, very intimate relationship of the 90s anytime soon, but I think we have seen the worst of it, and we could have stayed there at the bottom of the relationship had the Arab Spring not started, causing both the Turks and the Israelis to say, you know what, maybe it's time for us to get over it, because we've got so much instability next door, or whatever happened between us is something we've kind of put a blank page on. So I would say you're going to see very gradual improvement in Turkish-Israeli ties. At least you're not going to see any more negative stuff, rhetoric or policy-wise. And I think you could even see significant improvement if one of the governments in one of these countries leaves office, because then the other one can always say, our problem was with the government, not with the country, and we can start a new phase, and that's where it's should be. Yes, thank you. We have time, right? So I think,
please, go ahead.
Great talk, but I think we are going to continue to see great conflict between Turkey and Israel, and in particular with respect to the offshore gas deposits, Leviathan,
yes.
And especially with respect to the emerging relationship between Greek Cypriots and Greece with Israel over that whole issue of actual money.
Yeah.
I think the Leviathan may be 250 billion barrels of natural gas. So they will continue to have points of conflict.
Yes, sir. I agree. I don't think this is a rosy relationship. I think the gas issue in Eastern Med is probably not going to be as problematic as it looked when it first started. One of the reasons is that when the Greek Cypriots, this is the island of Cyprus, this is the Eastern Med, this is Turkey, there is Israel, there is Lebanon, there is Cyprus, and there are gas deposits here. They're large fields, and every country has what's called an exclusive economic zone that it can declare up to 200 miles. Everything on it and under it is theirs, and it kind of runs like this. So some of it is in Cyprus, some of it is in Israel. There's a lot of gas in Eastern Med. So the question was, can they share, and what's the Turkish role? Because you know Cyprus is a divided island. The north is Turkish control, the south is Greek majority. So now everybody says the gas is theirs. The Turkish Cypriots say it's theirs, the Greek Cypriots say it's theirs, the Israelis say it's theirs. When the gas finds were first became public, this was just right after the Flotilla incident, when nerves were raw, the Turks came up and said, of course it belongs to the Turkish Cypriots, and we'll defend them, if necessary, by sending our Navy to confront both the Turkish Cypriots and the Israelis. And I think that's when Prime Minister Erdogan got a phone call from President Obama. He said, no, we're not doing that. And then the Turkish position backpedaled, and they said, no, we didn't mean the Israelis, it's all about the Greek Cypriots. I think it's really not the problem that the Turks and Israelis are going to deal with. It's a problem that Turks and Greek Cypriots are going to deal with. The really good news, sometimes it's good news, is that the gas fines are not as huge as they thought they were. Right? Can you imagine if it was big, because then it's a bigger piece of pie to fight for. And I think at the moment, this is an issue that Turks and Greek Cypriots will fight over. It's yet one more layer to Turkey's long-term conflict with Cyprus. There's always talks about bringing the islands to disparate parts together. Can I be a skeptical person? Yeah, okay. I think Cyprus will be united when there is Arab-Israeli peace, or the other way around. Down the road somewhere, but not anytime soon. I think this is just adding more conflict to the issue, but it's not going to make it anything more serious. Turks and Greek Cypriots are not going to fight over this issue. Turkey and Greece are not going to fight over this issue. So I kind of look at this as political, but not a combustible issue. And I think the Israeli side of it has been taken care of. What the president had made is very clear that Turkey has no role to say about Israeli gas funds because they don't relate to Turkey's exclusive economic zone or territory.
We have time for one more question.
Exhausted.
Well, thank you very much, and we actually
Always a pleasure. You can follow up if you have any follow-up questions or issues. I'm on the Institute's website, washingtoninstitute.org. I'm also on Facebook, so I'll meet you there.